stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 277 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Melrose, Massachusetts. I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from
I'm not entirely sure where I am either. I'm somewhere near Taos, New Mexico.
Oh, I hear that's pretty.
It is very pretty. It is nice. Cold as well. Although we're actually I guess the last episode that we did, I was in. Not Austin. I just left Austin, and I was in, what's that town with the Riverwalk in Texas? San Antonio. I was in San Antonio, and I was on my way to Big Bend National Park, which is where we spent the last week or so. And I did get to meet Brian Devonshire, which was very cool, and actually came in handy. So Emily and I showed up at Big Bend the Sunday before Thanksgiving, and I guess a lot of people in Texas get the entire week of Thanksgiving off, or schools do or something, because the park was like slammed. There was like no camping available in the park, period. Like, there's a couple of official campgrounds, and then there's also permits for like backcountry camping, where you just kind of like drive down a dirt road, and there's like specific spots where you can camp. So like, every single one of those spots was full. I mean, there are some towns that are kind of like outside of Big Bend, but like outside of Big Bend is like an hour drive from stuff. Like, it's a very large place. We actually were able to stay at Brian's compound. Like, the rafting company that he works for, you know, they have like an area where a lot of their guides sleep, either in tents or in little trailers or mobile homes or whatever. And you know, Brian has a trailer set up there, and so he was able to arrange that we could set up a tent on their property there, which was very handy for Sunday night. And then after that, we were able to get a proper camping space elsewhere. But yeah, so he came in handy, but also he was a very fun person to hang out with. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to meet up with him again while we were in the area. Again, it's a very large area, and it's difficult to coordinate with people because for the most part, you don't have cell coverage or Wi-Fi or anything like that. So I was not able to get in touch with him again, but it was definitely very cool to meet him in person.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. And as we record this, Bitcoin is up more than 10% since midnight. So he's probably a happy guy right now.
Yeah, he's yes. Yeah, he has remained a believer when many in the poker world have lost interest or turned their attention elsewhere.
Yeah. So there's something going on Twitter that I just like have an impression of, and it's almost like too good to check. Like, I don't want to look into the details too carefully, but it's like everybody who was really into crypto like a year and a half ago and like really excited and, you know, like, I've got a podcast. I talk about all the altcoins. Like, it seems like they're now just obsessed with like fad diets and chess. And it's like, it's really cute or whatever. It's like, they sort of, you know, it's not about how rich they are. It's, you know, it's, how could Magnus Carlsen have offered the draw? That's insane. And, you know, how many eggs have you eaten today? I have eaten 11 eggs today. Let's not talk about Ethereum.
Yeah, I was, there's a couple of Baltimore area poker players I kind of said initially, like, the reason that I bought some Bitcoin was so that I wouldn't have to listen to poker players brag about having Bitcoin. And then, you know, that was shortly before the Bitcoin went down. And then there were a couple of Baltimore area poker players who were bragging about not having Bitcoin. And I was like, now I have to listen to poker players brag about not having Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's a funny world sometimes.
So I have a couple of asks for people listening. Well, I guess the first thing we should say is that this is going to be a full-on strategy episode. I know we've only done one episode in the last 3 weeks, and that's my fault. That's related to my having been in remote places like Big Bend National Park and otherwise being occupied. So I do feel like I owe you guys a little bit in that regard. And then I know our most recent episode was not really very much about poker at all. So we have got an episode today crammed full of strategy. If you want even more strategy, you should check out our strategy sponsor, Tournament Poker Edge. And there you'll find hundreds of videos from myself and dozens of other instructors. Nate's even got a few on there. And these videos get in depth on basically everything that you could want to know about tournament poker, wide variety of concepts, wide variety of playing styles tailored to a wide variety of ability levels, something like 10 years worth of archives of videos there, new videos added almost every single day. You can sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. I also want to let you all know, with the holidays coming, there's a very cheap and easy way that you can support the podcast here. What Nate and I are doing, not going to cost you anything at all, actually. So to say cheap is even is an overstatement. If you just use our affiliate link for any Amazon shopping that you do, we'll get a little cut of your purchase. Shouldn't cost you anything extra. Details or the link for that I'm going to put in the show notes for this episode. You can also find it if you just go to thinkingpoker.net and click on the support the podcast tab. You'll find links not just for amazon.com, but for like the .uk, .ca, .fr. We've got a bunch of the different localizations of Amazon. We've got affiliate links for those. So certainly keep us in mind when you're doing your holiday shopping this year. We would appreciate that. Other good holiday gifts. Nate and I do have some books and some premium podcasts available at our store, nitcast.com, nitcast.com. Some of these are things that we've worked on together. Some of them are things that we've made individually. They're all pretty affordably priced and make nice gifts. If you're not sure which one to get, now you can feel free to write us podcast@thinkingpoker.net, which is also, of course, the place to write us if you want to compliment the show, complain about the show, recommend guests, strategy questions, all that sort of stuff, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Or if you tweet at us, I'm at thinkingpoker, Nate is at Nate Mavis. Any of those, if you want to ask, you know, hey, what do you think I should get for so-and-so for Christmas this year? You know, assuming that so-and-so is interested in poker in some way. I'd be happy to make some recommendations about what might make the most sense for you. And finally, then this is a very personal ask for me. Well, I guess first I should emphasize that Nate and I really are grateful to anyone who chooses to spend an hour or so of their time with us every week, especially those of you who write us, leave comments, tweet at us, etc. So that really is the best gift of all, and we don't have an expectation that people are going to do anything more than that. That said, if you are inclined to go above and beyond, this is the time of year to do it. As many of you probably know, I was heavily involved in competitive debate in high school and in college, and I've worked for nearly 20 years with organizations that cultivate debate programs in urban public high schools. In fact, one of my former students, Josh Nixon, has been a guest on this podcast a couple of times, so you can check him out if you're interested in finding out what's going on now with someone who debated something like 10 years ago in one of these programs. The organization that I work with currently is the Bay Area Urban Debate League. I'm actually a member of the board there, so I can tell you with confidence that their governance is strong and they use their money well. As I have in past years, I'm doing a year-end fundraiser for them. The way it's going to work this year, every person who donates $5 or more gets to ask a question, preferably about poker, but I guess if you want to ask about something other than poker, I'll do my best. And then I'm going to record some special podcast episodes where I go through and answer all these questions that you all ask, and I'm going to share those with everyone who donated. So it's $5 to get in on that. Certainly appreciate if you want to make a larger donation than $5, but $5 is all it takes. You get to put up a question, and I will put it on the podcast episode. In fact, I'll even invite you if you want to ask more than one question. I may take the liberty of just choosing one, but if you ask multiple good questions, I'll probably answer multiple good questions. So you can even pass along several questions if you want. To make your contribution, you can follow the link in the show notes. If you're not sure what I mean when I say show notes, just go to thinkingpoker.net and you'll find a link in the first or second post there. I'll also be tweeting the link plenty. So even if you're not on Twitter, you can find that www.twitter.com/thinkingpoker if you want to find the link on Twitter that way. I think that's going to be easier than me trying to read it to you out loud.
And that goes for me too. If you the same $5 donation, if you want to ask a question to Andrew, or if you want to ask a question to me, you can do that also. And if there are questions directed at me, I will join Andrew for at least one of the relevant podcast episodes.
And I don't want to make a commitment on anyone else's behalf, but I think there's a decent chance if you have a question for Carlos, I could probably convince him to ask it as well. And he's probably a more interesting to ask question, a more interesting person to ask questions of if your question is about anything other than poker.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in a lot of cases, if your question is about poker.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, at least like the things that, yeah. It's a funny thing about talking poker with Carlos is like, he's very focused, like as a professional. And like when he asks me a question, it's like, dude, you're like the best player I know at these specific. Are you sure my answer will add much to what you're doing? Yeah. So yes, ask us questions. Send the Bay Area Urban Debate League money. I have one very short thing for preamble. It is not charitable, and however. It happens more often than I thought. So I've been in business for myself for a while now. It happens more often than I thought that people have money in their budgets at the end of the year. If you are one of these people with money in your budget at the end of the year and you want to turn that into software or data analysis or machine learning or something like that, let us know. We have a little bit of capacity, so we can do that for you, possibly even on short notice. Yeah, at first I thought it was just sort of a thing people said, but it turns out this is actually real, and it's something we prepare for now. So that's that. Nate@blackhound.io for this sort of inquiry. That's Nate@blackhound, BlackHound.io.
I think this is the first time I heard that name. Yeah, had you shared that with me before?
Probably not.
Well, I like it. I assume your hound is black.
My black and tan, yeah. But blackandtanhound.io, it's was also available, I think. But bang, blackhound.io.
Yeah, even just black and tan could be a little loaded.
Yeah.
I think you made a good choice.
Yeah, I'm happy about it. The logo is in fact a depiction of our dog. So, I like to think that I'm getting Raylan's handsome profile out in circulation by doing my job.
We've got, I'm tempted to say more than one strategy question. We've got a hand, but I think it contains several interesting strategy questions within it. This is coming to us from Shane, who I know is a longtime listener. He says, "Hi, Andrew and Nate. Thanks again for the continued excellence in your podcasts and written pieces. Always enjoy listening to / reading your content." Well, thanks for listening, Shane.
Thanks.
I wanted to submit this hand for your consideration. It's a hand where I won a big pot, but I don't think I played it well enough to get max value. I've been spending more time lately trying to see where I can improve my play to extract more value on hands where I win big pots. It's also a hand where I deviate a bit from my standard play. Curious about your thoughts around that. So this is a great way to get my attention if you're sending hands in for podcast consideration. I respect a lot people who are doing exactly what Shane is talking about, which is not just going through and looking at like, oh, here's a spot where I lost a big pot. Like, how could I have done something differently so that I would have won it instead? Or how could I have, not lost as much? Money not won is just as much of a loss as money lost. And I think it's many people undervalue that when they're doing their poker study. So props to Shane. He's setting a good example here. I'm not saying this is the only thing you should be looking at, but it's something that I think a lot of people overlook.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's really great. I'll say there's sort of a next level trap that people fall into sometimes, which is taking it as a given that they're going to win the pot. And thinking like, oh man, like either it's obvious, like thinking it's obvious after the fact that their opponent had a payoff hand or like a good payoff hand. It's like, why didn't I value bet bigger? And it's like, sometimes you were right. Sometimes he usually just has second pair and he's not going to pay off much like that. And this time he had an overpair or whatever. So there are some other traps you can fall into, but to win a pot, I then think like, oh, how could I have played better, and like not take it for granted that that you played well. And that's really good. And to get beyond the point where you're thinking that, like, the point of poker is to win pots, and I won the pot, so everything's fine. That's a big step. So here's to you, Shane.
This is a 2-cent, 5-cent, no-limit hold'em Zoom poker game, six-handed on Bovada, which I guess would technically make it zone poker. I'm first to act with black queens. I elect to limp, which is varying my play and a bit of an experiment. About 90% of the time, I will make a standard raise to 3-big blind with this sort of hand. But in these zone games, it's not infrequent to see limpers, and they almost always get raised. So I have started limping big hands occasionally, hoping to get raised and be able to play a hand against a worse range. I can also limp baby pairs and suited connectors like this occasionally to maintain a balanced range. So this brings up the first question related to playing in a zone game. How much value is there in balance in this type of deception for a zone game where I face different and anonymous players every hand? In a set table, I certainly want to vary my play to remain unpredictable and see great importance in some form of GTO play. But in this situation, does it make sense to just be full on exploitive? Theoretically, GTO play should apply regardless of whether it's a single iteration game or a repeated game. So I think perhaps it makes sense to continue along these lines, even if players will not, quote, give me credit for being unpredictable in later hands. It matters regardless of reputation effects, right? Curious about your thoughts here. And I might just try to summarize that a little bit in case people aren't clear on what he's asking. I believe what he's saying is, you know, should I be thinking about things like balance or being unpredictable if I'm playing anonymously against people who, you know, even if I do encounter them again, they're not going to know that it's the same person. Like, are there reasons to be unpredictable or balanced that don't have to do with establishing a reputation that will help me play against people in the future? Do you want to dive into this one first?
Yeah, I think Shane got it about right. So balance is something that exists, whether or not you know who your opponents are. And yes, like in theory, not bluffing is a problem, and not just because you'll be diachronically predictable. You know, you also have to worry about being synchronically predictable and synchronically balanced. So. Yes, Shane is right about that. Against the 2-cent, 5-cent player pool on Bovada, it's okay to be pretty exploitable, I think. And you know, certainly Shane is right that you shouldn't be making image plays when there are no images. So I think Shane's basically right there. Yeah, it's sort of a game theory 101 thing. Balance is you know, it's not like somebody can just opt out of the game theory side of poker by having amnesia, right? so it always exists, but you know, some of the exploitive stuff that goes on over time with stable identities, that's not there in a zone poker game.
I think the way I tend to try to explain this to people, he says, you know, is it better to be balanced or to be full on exploitive? And what I'm inclined to say is you should be exploitive when you have something to exploit. You know, now it may be true that you have to be concerned about against a person that you play against regularly, if you've been exploiting them for a long time. For instance, if you believe that a certain opponent of yours folds too much on the river and you play with this person several times a week and you've been just constantly bluffing them on the river, you might need to keep in mind that, like, at some point this person might change the way they play and start calling more often on the river because you've been doing this over and over and over again. So that's kind of a judgment call in terms of how much you want to take that into consideration. And I think that's not going to apply in a zone game. Like, if you have some reason to believe maybe just that the population in general in zone folds too much on the river, then you can just, like, repeatedly bluff the river, bluff the river, bluff the river, and expect that to kind of continue working more or less indefinitely, or at least until, like, there's a big shift in, like, the way the population plays in zone or something like that. The trickier situation is sometimes, even if you know that your opponents are bad, like, okay, you're playing 2-cent, 5-cent poker, your opponents are probably making plenty of mistakes. So I don't think that you need to be balanced in the sense of, I don't think you need to be worried about balance in the sense of, you know, what if they're thinking six levels ahead of me? I better make sure I'm not doing anything exploitable. However, just because your opponents are poor doesn't necessarily mean that you know exactly what mistakes they're making or exactly how to take advantage of those. And so if you have something that you believe you can exploit, yeah, certainly go ahead and exploit it, and you don't have to worry about you know, sort of overdoing it or making it so obvious what you're exploiting that people end up like plugging that leak the way you might have to worry about if it were a regular opponent. But there's going to be plenty of situations where the right play is not obvious to you, where, you know, you get to the river, you have a weak hand, and, you know, is your opponent going to fold? Should you bluff? You don't necessarily know the answer to that question. And that's where I think game theory is most useful, is when you don't really know what you're going to be able to exploit. And one reason you might not know how you're going to exploit an opponent is just that they're very good and you're not comfortable, you know, assuming something exploitive that you could do. But another case is just you're not familiar with the player, and that's going to come up all the time in zone. You may be comfortable making assumptions about how like a generic 2-cent, 5-cent zone player plays, but you're not going to have player specific reads to say, you know, this player check raises too much on the flop, this player doesn't check raise enough on the flop. And so if you don't really have an assumption to make about how often you're going to get check raised on the flop, then you probably want to play a flop betting strategy that's resilient to a variety of check raising strategies, meaning you have some hands that want to get check raised and some hands that don't want to get check raised in your flop betting range, for example.
I like it.
Anyhow. Oh, so, but, and then the specific question of limping queens under the gun. So the thing that Shane says is that he's going to be able to play against a wider range as a result of limping than if he had raised. And I think that's the important way to frame it is, you know, will your opponent, like, essentially, if you're thinking about it in terms of either I'm going to raise and my opponent's going to call with a range of hands, or I'm going to limp and my opponent's going to raise with a range of hands, which one of those ranges is larger, right? You probably want to play against the wider range if you have pocket queens. It's not 100% true. Like, there might be some hands that you'd actually prefer that he folded when you had queens, but for the most part, like, you'd rather play against the wider range. A lot of those hands that are getting added to the range are hands that queens are doing very, very well against. So if you believe that limping is going to cause your opponent to raise with a wider range of hands than he would have called your raise with, then that's probably worth doing, especially if you think that it's going to be profitable to limp re-raise. And we're going to get into that question in a second. So, I mean, first, there's just the question of, even if you're not going to re-raise, if you're just going to limp and call, limping and calling could still be more profitable than raising if you think your opponent is going to raise more hands than he would have called with if you limped. That's probably not how someone should actually play in theory. But again, this comes on to that question of, are you comfortable making exploitive assumptions about people? And it sounds like Shane is. He said, you know, it sounds like he's saying he sees limps get raised a lot. I mean, if it's really true that limps are getting raised 90% of the time, then yeah, people are certainly raising with pretty wide ranges when people are limping. Even if that number is closer to 75%, that's still going to make limping under the gun probably pretty desirable relative to raising. I wouldn't even feel obliged to balance by limping other types of hands. I mean, if you just think people are going to raise way too much, you don't need to worry about it. I mean, that's one of those cases where you don't need to worry about being balanced. If you're already comfortable making the assumption that people are going to raise too much, then just only limp hands that you want to get raised with.
Yep. And on the psychological side, I think it's really nice to consider plays that look like fish plays. When they're right in the situation. So the trap is that you see a limp get raised a couple times and you're like, ah, these zone players, 2 cent, 5 cent, they'll just raise any limp, that they're just crazy. And the danger is that you draw the conclusion on insufficient evidence. But there's this other trap, which is that you notice the tendency and then you don't do what's necessary to profitably react to it because it looks like a fish play. There are these famous stories of in like a limit hold'em game, like five people limping around and then the small blind completing because that's what, you know, the small blind should obviously do, but, you know, forgetting that the big blind is going to raise every time because he's raised every hand for the last 6 hours. This is like a famous story that gets told about, you know, like some supposedly great player who just like wasn't very good at reacting to his conditions or something. So like it's like and it feels bad to fold whatever 7-4 offsuit in the small blind for half a bet and limit hold'em when you're getting such a good price, but like you have to think the next step ahead and realize the situation you're in. So I think Shane's doing a really good thing by saying like, look, I'm in a game where people just sort of ignore or be too eager to pounce on early position limps. So why should I raise and say a lot about the strength of my hand and lay my opponents a better price when I could just limp and let them put the money in for me, and then I can make a decision? And so I think that's great. And yeah, like consider plays like that that look like fish plays. Like even if you ordinarily would never open limp from early position, you know, you should consider it in some situations.
Where I thought you might be going with that, which I think is also good, is that it may cause your opponents to play badly against you, even just further along in this same hand. Even though this is a, yeah, you know, anonymous game, people are not going to be able to make a note that says, like, this guy's a fish. They may, like, if they just see you limp and they immediately think, oh, this guy's just some fish, like, that may enable you to do things, yep, just later in this hand that you wouldn't be able to get away with if they thought you were a better player.
Yep, that too.
Anyway, back to Shane. Shane says, I limp queens and immediately get raised to 20 cents, four big blinds, by under the gun plus one. So far, so good. Fold back around to me. Here, I generally apply a mix of back raising and calling. With additional callers, I will almost always implement the back raise squeeze with queens through aces. In this hand, I have $10.50 in my stack, and villain has me covered, so we're at 210 blinds, fairly deep and heads up. I elect to call, keeping the pot small out of position, and will not put in too much more money on ace-high flops. I will also play this way with some suited aces so I can cover those boards as well. We go to the flop with 47 cents in the pot. This raises another, I guess, common misunderstanding, although I'm not sure that Shane actually misunderstands it, but it's a thing that I want to address related to game theory and the idea of mixed strategies. So I think it's become a kind of popular thing to say, like, well, you got to mix and you got to do this sometimes and do another thing sometimes, or, you know, sometimes I call, sometimes I raise with this hand. Now, it may be true that, you know, against different sorts of opponents, you might choose to call, you know, versus raise with a particular hand. Like, you might not always limp re-raise aces just because you limped it under the gun, but it might depend on factors like what position the raise came from, how many people call, who the opponent is, that sort of thing. I would say that if we keep all those other factors the same, if we say stack sizes are the same, positions are the same, the opponent is the same, you know, should you be doing something like, in this exact spot, I'm going to call 20% with queens and re-raise with queens 80% of the time? I think the answer to that is probably no. Like, probably either calling or raising is the better thing to do in this exact situation, and you just want to do that thing 100% of the time. The time that mixed strategies show up is when two options have exactly the same expected value, right? If calling and raising are exactly equally as good for you, then there might be reasons to do some of each. That can come up a lot if you're working with, like, a game theory solver. I mean, if you do something in Pio Solver starting from the flop, you're going to see a huge number of hands playing a mixed strategy. But in practice, when you're playing against especially, like, 2 cent, 5 cent players, there's probably just a better play. Like, your opponents are probably going to make some sort of mistake. There's some place where they're going to be imbalanced, and you should likely be able to identify what that thing is going to be and then just make the better play. Like, I don't think that you want to just need to, like, I don't think you need to be mixing just for the sake of balance or something like that. Even if you're trying to play, like, a game theoretically optimal strategy, there are many situations where you're just going to do something 100% of the time. Like, balance is not a goal in and of itself. In this exact spot, I'd be pretty inclined to re-raise, especially if you think, so, I mean, on the one hand, under the gun one is a pretty strong position for this player to be raising from, and, like, presumably he'd have a wider range if he opened from the button. That said, the whole reason we limped in the first place is that we thought people were going to raise with overly wide ranges. And it's, I mean, there are very few hands that are better than queens. And there are a lot of hands that are going to raise here that queens would like to re-raise against, either because those hands have a decent amount of equity and we'd love to fold them out, especially if they're going to be in position later. I mean, that even includes hands like 10-9 of diamonds or something. I mean, you have two overcards of 10-9 of diamonds, but at the same time, it's not really a hand that's going to make a huge mistake against you after the flop. I mean, maybe I'm overestimating a player in a 2 cent, 5 cent game, but I think even if you happen to get like a 9 or a 10 high board, which doesn't happen that much, I'm still not sure that you just get stacks in when someone has 10-9 and you have pocket queens and you're 200 big blinds deep. So I think, like, there's even when players hold hands like those, I think there's a decent amount of value in limp re-raising, even if they just fold them, just to, like, deny them the opportunity to play that hand in position against you. Certainly when someone holds a hand like king jack suited and they have a live over card, you're pretty interested in getting folds or calls from that hand. Like, both of those things are better than just letting them see a cheap flop. So I see a lot of reasons to limp re-raise here. I also think if you do happen to get 4-bet, I mean, honestly, I'd feel pretty comfortable to saying the person probably has aces. I mean, I don't know how much you're going to see like light four bets in this sort of spot. So I wouldn't expect to get four bet very often if you limp re-raise. And if it does happen, your equity is probably really poor. So I'm not actually even that concerned about putting myself in an awkward spot if I get four bet. Like I would probably just fold unless the pivot was a really tiny four bet. So I think you're going to do very well against calling ranges. I think you're happy to get folds. I think that if you do get four bet, it's not going to happen often. And you can probably just fold, but you know, you actually benefit from having a low stack to pot ratio. Like if you make it a dollar here and get called, there's going to be like $9 in the stacks and $2 in the pot. That's a stack to pot ratio where even if you don't improve with a pair of queens, you just flop an over pair, it will likely be comfortable for you to get the money in. Whereas if you just limp and call, you're going to end up with like 40 cents in the pot and $10 in the stacks. And that's a much more uncomfortable stack depth to be playing an overpair, right? There's not very many boards where you're going to feel comfortable stacking off with queens with that shallow of, or sorry, with that deep of stacks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I don't think there's much reason to mix it up here just for the sake of having a mixed strategy. It's something that Shane mentioned. Like, I think, you know, different variants of the situation might call for different plays, but for the most part, in an anonymous setting, one play is going to be better than the other here. And in theory, you're going to want to mix it up in some common situations at some stack depths, but when it goes limp, raise, and you're this deep and you have queens, you know, in a situation like this, anonymous, one play is going to be better than the other for the most part. and I think that play is re-raising.
Yeah.
Calling's not terrible, but I would definitely re-raise.
As it happens, he does call, Shane calls, and we go to the flop, 47 cents in the pot, and the flop is a pretty good one for Shane. Queen of diamonds, jack of clubs, nine of diamonds, giving him top set, and he says the second nuts in his email. Technically, it's the third nuts. King 10 and 10-8 are ahead of him. King 10 probably more likely as a raising hand than 10-8, but wouldn't rule it out. He says, I suppose an argument could be made for betting out on this draw-heavy board. I can have a lot of draws and all the two-pair hands. I don't really have jacks or nines for sets played this way very much, though, as I'm always open raising those pre-flop, and I think middle or bottom sets make for better leads than top set. Nor do I generally have ace-queen. I expect a continuation bet a lot of the time, so I check with a plan to check raise, and I would likely check raise top set, draws, some two-pair hands, maybe aces or kings, although more likely I check call those on this wet board. Villain can have a lot of queens he might bet, jacks and nines for sets, aces and kings, draws like ace 10, queen 10, jack 10, pocket 10s, flush draws. He could also have king 10, which is not really in my range, although I can't worry too much about that. What do you think, Nate? Case for betting?
Given that you check called, I think I would just check. I think I would just check. I think I like Shane's reasoning there. And I think a lot of people will continue. Not that he should bet with his A7 offsuit if you checked, but I think some people will, and that's really good for you. and I really want to have re-raised. I mean, never mind that you flopped a set. Like, when the stack to pot ratio is 9-2, like, it's pretty easy to bet and then just get jammed on here by, like, anything, any pair in a draw, any draw, any pair. Like, even if you change the hand around and don't give me the third nuts, like, there are just so many flops where you want the money to go in, and you want the stacks to be short.
Yeah, I think having come this far in the hand the way we have, at this point we have a pretty well-concealed hand. I don't think in general this is a board, like if you think about whatever your limp calling range looks like, I don't think in general this is really a board that you want to be building a pot. But like, I think it's a board that's pretty favorable for the preflop raiser as opposed to the preflop limp caller. And I think you can maintain a lot of deception by checking. And so I want to be clear that when I'm talking about deception by checking, I'm not just saying like, oh, it's deceptive because we have a strong hand and we're checking. I'm saying like there are plenty of situations where you're going to be betting lots of weak hands, and then it's deceptive to bet your strong hands also. This happens to be a case where you're going to be checking a lot of weak hands. And in fact, you're going to be checking like the majority of the time in this situation, I think. So you can can be deceptive by also checking strong hands here. As Shane points out, your opponent has a lot of incentive to value bet. The one caveat I'll put out there is given that you hold two queens, it's actually not very likely that your opponent has top pair. But that could be a case for checking as well. I mean, it may be that, you know, he has, for instance, 16 combinations of ace-king that miss this flop and are probably drawing, most of them are drawing pretty thin. Ace-king with a flush draw is in pretty good shape. But other than that, his ace-kings are drawing pretty thin. So, you know, it may be that either he hit this flop pretty hard, where he's got like pair plus draw, set, two pair, or he missed the flop pretty hard. There's not a lot of hands kind of in between, which are the ones that where I'd be most concerned about betting. Like the you know, I would want to bet if I were trying to deny him the opportunity to like play pot control with ace jack or something like that. But I think those kinds of hands are not that prevalent in his range. I think he's more likely to have either very strong or very weak hands. And that's a pretty good argument for checking, because the very weak hands, like, you'd love to give them a chance to bluff. You don't really mind giving them a free card. And then the very strong hands are likely to bet for you. And then you'll have the opportunity to check raise them. So he does end up checking, and the villain checks back. What do you make of that, Nate? Are there hands that you would consider less likely as a result of him checking back, or more likely?
Yeah. So some of the best hands, I think, I mean, there's always the chance that somebody just thinks that he has to slow play because he has a great hand. But for the most part, I would say some complete whiffs will check back, and they should. And then some like pot controlling kinds of hands, like ace jack, I think makes a lot of sense. like that's sort of a canonical pot controlling kind of hand. So I think, yeah, the sorts of hands that would spring to mind are like ace deuce suited, you know, pocket threes, and then like ace jack. So like hands that hate this board, hands that want to pot control. And of course, other things are possible too. But those are the things that spring to mind. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think an interesting question is what he's going to do with aces or kings here. I think there are some people who are going to look at this board and say, actually, this is kind of a scary board for aces and kings. Maybe I want to check for pot control. I think that's less likely to happen at 2 cent, 5 cent. I think people are more likely to see a board with a lot of draws, see an overpair, and think, hey, I should bet to kind of protect my hand or take it down now or something along those lines. I also think the fact that the hero only limped and called pre-flop, even though he happens to have flopped the set, I think he's not going to be perceived as having that many really good hands on this board. So if this were a three bet pot, like if it had been hero opens under the gun one, three bets, hero calls, and we get this flop, I think it's much more likely that aces or kings might check this flop, because then hands like queens and jacks and nines would be, I would think, a much bigger part of under the gun's range, and I'd be more worried about, you know, trying to get aces and kings to show down without building a real big pot. When under the gun, our hero in this case, has only limped and called pre-flop, I would feel a lot better about holding aces or kings on this board. So I think there's some kind of sophisticated reasons to check, there's some sophisticated reasons to bet aces and kings, and I think there's some unsophisticated reasons to bet them. And so regardless of what sort of player this is, I think it's pretty likely he's betting if he has aces or kings. And I agree with you, Nate. The most likely check back hands are probably hands that have like a shred of showdown value, but look at this as a scary board. And then we might also just see some hands that whiffed entirely and are sort of giving up. And even ace king could be in that category. The turn is an offsuit jack. So the board now is queen, jack, nine, jack with two diamonds. And our hero has a full house. He says, I think this is great. Huh. The villain could have a lot of jacks in his range. Not uncommon to check back.
Like ace jack.
Yeah, exactly. given this, perhaps betting out around half pot is the best play, hoping to get raised. We're still quite deep with a stack to pot ratio of 22, so I need to start getting money into the pot. Best way to do that is to bet out rather than rely on villain to do my betting for me. Checking through again would be a disaster, although if it checks through, he's unlikely to have a hand that will put more money in anyways. I elect to check with a plan to check raise, which I now think may have been a mistake. My range is still quite wide, including aces through queens, although villain likely discounts those. Two pair hands that have now boated up, nut flush and other flush draws, some pair plus draw hands, and some air. By checking, I think I'd probably remove a lot of the air and draws from my range, as those would be more likely to bet out, lacking showdown value. Although given the jack pairing is a better card for his range, perhaps I'd like to check those draws more often than when a blank card hits the board. So basic question here is, what do we think? Bet or check?
Boy, I would bet. I will say, so one thing I want to mention with Shane's note is, like, he says he wants to bet half pot hoping to get raised, and he's got to start getting the money in because the stacks are so deep and there's not much time left. And, like, on the one hand, it's right to try to win big pots with your big hands. On the other hand, you can only win what's possible, and you just have to maximize your expectation, whether or not that's maximizing the chances that you get full stacks in. And so you should just be thinking about what bet is more profitable, and not, like, you know, you don't have any sort of separate obligation to try to get stacks in. And in particular, once somebody's checked back the flop here, if they're checking back at the flop and raising the turn, I'm not sure how sensitive they're going to be to your bet size. And I'm not sure that if you bet small, I mean, not that half pot is really small, but I'm not sure that betting small, it's just hard to see somebody having a good reason to check this flop and then seeing a small bet and saying, like, ah, that's weakness, I'm just gonna raise. I mean, I'm sure it happens sometimes, but for the most part, I think you need to think about people's ranges a little bit more precisely when you're trying to get raised. Okay, with that aside done, I think I would bet here, in part because some of the hands that will bet will raise, and there are probably some hands that are going to keep on, you know, trying to be happy to get to showdown that might call a bet. You know, you might be able to bet a little bit bigger and get a bigger bet called than the hand that might bet. I'm not sure a lot of hands will wake up and start bluffing now, especially at these stakes. So I would probably just bet and, you know, probably like 80% of the pot, and, you know, hope he has something and calls or raises. What do you think?
I agree with that. I'm inclined to think there's kind of three sorts of hands that he could have, and some of them are more likely than others. The one thing that you said, Nate, that it may not, like, if he actually has a really strong hand, I'm not sure if this is where you're going with that comment, but I think, like, if he has something like ace-jack, it might not matter terribly much what you do here. It could certainly matter a little bit. It might even be the difference between winning like $10 versus winning $6 or $7, which matters. But if we assume he's not going to have ace-jack that often in the first place, then if we're still going to do pretty well against ace-jack with a certain betting line that would also enable us to win a lot more from other parts of his range, it may make more sense to do that rather than to maximize against, like, specifically the very strongest part of his range. Like, if he has trips, we're going to win a decent amount of money no matter what. We might hurt our chances of getting full stacks in by doing, like, something different, but we could probably make up for that if it enables us to win more money from other parts of his range. The other kinds of hands he could have, yeah, he could have absolutely nothing, which I think you're right, Nate. Those hands are pretty unlikely to wake up and bluff no matter what you do. You might induce like one small bluff from them by checking. Like, maybe they think they were going to give up on the flop, but now you've shown weakness by checking twice. Maybe they'll take one stab at it. That's not a terribly profitable thing either. I think a lot of people who are going to bluff are going to do it on the flop, but some people, you just aren't going to bluff a second time regardless. And even if they do, you're not going to win that much from those hands. Those aren't really the hands I'd be thinking that much about. The biggest reason to bet, I think, is the kinds of pot control sorts of hands your opponent might have. Like, hands that he's thinking he might actually have a chance of winning if he takes them to showdown. They can beat a bluff, but he's not very inclined to put money in the pot with him unless he has to. Now, a lot of those are hands that probably shouldn't call a bet here. Ace-king can probably justify calling a bet here, although it's close. Those underpairs that you mentioned, like the pocket threes or something, really shouldn't be calling a bet here, although I think a lot of people will. Again, I would think in a two cent, 5 cent game, people are probably a lot looser than they should be. And I think some people will have a kind of unsophisticated thought process here that just goes, well, I checked the flop. My opponent could just be bluffing with anything. I have to call one bet when I have a pair. And then they call with pocket threes. So I think you get calls like those when you bet, which are nice. I think there's a decent chance you get called by ace-king when you bet, and it may not bet if checked too. And then, I mean, the very best case scenario is where the villain does have like a jack or he has pocket nines. There's a decent chance that he will raise if you bet. Whereas if, you know, you check, he bets, and you check raise, I think one of the things that the chain pointed out here is that's going to be a difficult thing to balance. And this is one of the cases where I would be a little bit more worried about balance. Not because this player has played with you many times and knows that you don't check raise bluffs in this sort of situation, but just because it's a difficult situation two check raise bluffs. Like, a lot of people don't check raise bluffs here very much. And the main reason for that is that there's a simpler way to bluff if you have nothing, which is you could just bet the turn. And so a lot of people are going to, if they want to bluff, they're going to do it by betting the turn, not by check raising. So I think there are some good reasons why a check raise is going to be perceived as very strong and unlikely to contain a lot of bluffs. There are probably even some good theoretical reasons why you are not actually going to be check raising that many bluffs in this situation. So yeah, I think check raising is a pretty problematic thing. And I think a lot of the benefits of check raising you still get from betting. In other words, you might win two or more bets from trips just by betting here, which, you know, Shane does acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Shane does in fact check. And he says, I'm happy to see Villain bet 33 cents into the 47 cent pot. I believe he has mostly jacks here. Most of his queens would bet this wet flop, as would aces and kings. He could have pocket tens. He could also have king 10. He says it's to slow play the flop with king 10 would be a mistake in my opinion, but not uncommon, which I agree with. He could also have some air, maybe lower pocket pairs, or an ace king, which decided not to see bet. Anyway, a raise is mandatory, and I think it should be big given the strength of my hand and the preponderance of jacks in his range. I love that analysis. I think that's absolutely right. Like, at this point, we're doing something pretty exploitive by check raising. I kind of made the argument that I think it's difficult to balance this with bluffs. So if we're check raising here, it has to be because we just think the villain's not going to do a lot of hand reading. He's just going to look at his hand, see that he has trips, and think, well, I'm not folding trips, and sort of not think about what a check raise might mean coming from the hero, in which case we're sort of treating him as, you know, pretty price insensitive and not doing a lot of hand reading. And so we should just focus on shoveling a lot of money into the pot. I wouldn't even rule out check raising bigger than pot. Are we on the same page so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he says, I like to go full pot, making a total of $1.46. This illustrates part of the problem I've put myself in. Even despite a large bet and pot size raise, I still have almost 3x pot behind if he calls the bet. Further, I really don't think I have too many bluffs here. Probably a hole in my game, but I would likely bet out with bluffs rather than check raise big with them. I probably need to take some combo draws and put them in here. There's just not too much to bluff with. I'm weighted towards value and I'm relying on him calling with most of his jacks. Thinking about it now though, given the wet flop, he might bet most jacks on the flop as king jack and ten jack are pair plus draw, queen jack and jack nine are two pair. Yeah, I mean, I guess we've addressed a lot of this already. I mean, I think at this point he's basically on the right track. Like, we just have to assume or hope he has a pretty big hand. And if he does, I mean, if he has nothing, he's not calling a check raise no matter what the size is. Like, I don't think there's too many hands that are going to call a pot size check raise, but not call like 1.5x pot. And I think it makes sense to look at the stacks and say, if I want to get stacks in by the river, rather than just making a pot now and then having to either, you know, not get stacks in on the river or bet 3x pot to get stacks in on the river, think about just, you know, how maybe if I do it 1.5x pot now, then something more like 1.5x to 2x pot on the river gets the stacks in. And that's probably a better way of doing it than trying to just check raise pot on the turn and then really blow it up with a very large shove on the river. I don't think it makes a huge difference, but yeah, the more that you can do that planning about how am I going to get all the money in rather than just, you know, hitting a pop button, I think the better.
Yep. I think that is all great. And especially because Shane has obviously said a lot of smart things and we've said a lot of nice things about Shane's analysis here. I can give him a little bit of a hard time. Hey Shane, you know what a good way to get all the money is? Don't just call before the flop. Like, you have a good hand, you know. It's like you re-raise before the flop, then it's a little bit easier to you know, win a pot. I know you're out of position. You have queens. Okay.
I mean, I think this is a thing that people miss with overpairs when they're deep, though. Like, they kind of imagine all the situations where they 3-bet and then all they have is an unimproved overpair. But, I mean, pocket pairs are also, like, draws to pretty nutty hands in 3-bet pots. Yep. You know, early street aggression is best with hands that are going to have the potential to turn into nut hands. And pocket pairs actually do, a lot more so than like ace-king offsuit does. If you're 200 big blinds deep in a 3-bet pot, you're a lot, like, if you get an ace or a king high board, even in a 3-bet pot, you're not necessarily going to be, if you're 200 big blinds deep, you might not be that excited about playing for stacks with ace-king. If you get a queen high board after you 3-bet queens, then you're going to be pretty excited about playing for stacks. So when you're this deep, you do kind of want to think about your hand a little bit as like a draw to a set, among other things. And
yep. I mean, yep. Yeah. And I mean, No, we have, but like it's always good to remember. Like one reason you re-raise with Ace King at 100 big blind stacks so often is because you want to turn those one pair hands into effective nut hands. Like it's because Ace King doesn't make the nuts, but does make a lot of like very, you know, good, you know, very good, not great hands. And like part of what you're doing is engineering the stack sizes so that it matters a lot whether you have a very good hand and less whether you have a nut hand. And those are all reasons to get money in the pot with queens when you're this deep. Okay, good. We can stop repeating ourselves on that.
Villain calls the pot size check raise on the turn, and we go to the river with 339 in the pot and 880 in the effective stacks. So I will say this is closer to 2x pot than 3x pot. I was just sort of taking his word for the stack sizes. But yeah, that's making me want it even more to just check raise a little bit more than pot and then set up better sized stacks for shoving on the river. River is the 5 of hearts, making the final board queen, jack, 9, jack, 5 with a flush draw that missed. Shane says, given that Villain called the turn, I think he must have strength, so I need to bet the river big. I elect to overbet about 1.5x pot, $5.18. Although I expect he would bet most two pair hands on the flop, he can still have boats in his range, which I anticipate he will never fold. He can also have king 10 for a straight, also pocket jacks, which beat me, although that's kind of beside the point. He might also call with ace jack, king jack, or jack 10. I expect if I check, he will almost always check back, or bet smaller and likely fold to a check raise. So I go big. Is a shove better? Perhaps so. I don't know if he's that sensitive to 1.5 pot versus 2.5 pot. If he's calling, then he's probably calling a shove too. Yeah, I'm pretty inclined to agree with all of that. I think that's pretty in line with what we've said so far.
Yes.
Results. Villain calls. Shane wins a nice pot, and Shane says, I checked the hand history later. Turned out he had ace jack of diamonds for trips and the nut flush draw. So I win a nice pot, but I still don't feel like I played it that well. I ended up getting lucky to get in as much money as I did, and I still left $3.66, or 73 blinds in my stack, which is a lot of value to lose out on. Viewed in that way, perhaps this is the worst hand I played all session. Lots of ways I could have played it differently to get the entire stack in, and I don't think it just comes down to going bigger on the river. Also shows how being out of position sucks. In position, I likely play more aggressively and get the full double up. I think he's right.
I think he is. I should also say, for the sake of, you know, giving unbiased advice, I did not look at the results before I analyzed this hand on air. And you said, oh, Villain has ace jack. And like the first thing I think to myself is like, ah, I nailed it. It's like the first hand I mentioned. I'm so smart. And then you said like of diamonds. So it turns out he actually had like the pair and a nut flush draw, and he checked that hand. And that's a very different hand type and not something that crossed my mind as something that he would check back on the flop. So now I do not feel smart anymore.
I will say, I mean, it's kind of scary to me that this Shane person that we're corresponding with is playing 2 cent, 5 cent with thought processes like this. Like, poker really has gotten a lot harder.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I will say, and I'm talking about myself more than I'm talking about Shane or anybody else. You know, there are people who talk better than they play. And there's that. But yeah, I mean, I've played some micro stakes, not all that recently, but, as somebody who played micro stakes in 2005 and, you know, also like I found a random $20 in my Bovada account, like maybe a year ago, micro stakes a lot harder than they used to be. Yeah. And, Shane seems like a smart guy who's thought a lot about poker. Yeah. Poker, not what it used to be.
Thanks very much.
Also, Bitcoin is down, so that's
Thanks, Shane, for writing to us. I think that was, as I hope we indicated, a very, very interesting questions and very well thought out hand in general. I think it's very unlikely this is actually the worst hand that you played. It's possible that you cost yourself more money in this hand than any other one, but that's not at all the same as it having been the worst hand that you played all session. And I think there's a lot to be proud of here, both in your willingness to ask questions about this hand in the first place and in the quality of questions that you're asking. Can we squeeze in this one other short ethics question, Nate?
Yeah, let's keep it short. It has one of my favorite first sentences.
That's a big part of why I want to read this. Yeah. Especially since we plugged the affiliate link earlier in this episode. This is coming from Mike from New Jersey. Mike says, "Hi, it's Mike from New Jersey. You may remember me from such Amazon affiliate link purchases as Toilet Bowl Pumice Cleaning Stone, Temptations Cat Treats, or Omega-3 Fish Oil." So thanks for using the affiliate link, Mike, and thanks for giving both of us a chuckle with your opening line. It got your question on the air. I have a rulings and possibly ethics-related question I'd love your thoughts on. I was playing 2-5 at the new Resorts World Casino in the Catskills. Not a bad little room, and I'll definitely go back again when I'm in the area. The details of the actual hand in question are inconsequential. On the turn, in a three-way pot, about 2K effective, I checked first act. The next player bet 50 into 100, and the button called. Each player used two dark green $25 chips, the darkest green I've ever seen for a $25 chip, for their action. I did not say anything and check raised to 250 using two greens and two blacks. The initial bettor snap put in two more $25 chips. The dealer told him the bet was $250. He said he just wanted to take back the two 25s and fold. The dealer said he couldn't do that. The floor was called and ruled that the player can fold his hand and leave the two 25s out there, or he can call the entirety of the $250 bet. While this was going on, the player turned to me and asked if he could take the $50 back, as he didn't know that the raise was the 250. I said he could take back the two 25s. The floor said he could not take back the two 25s, and they had to stay in the pot. The player told the floor that I had said it was okay for him to take him back, but the floor said because there was a third player still in the hand, even though it seemed like he was going to fold, the money would have to stay in the pot. The player angrily folded, the third player also folded, and I took down the pot. I don't know what my ethical responsibility is with respect to the bet. The chips do look relatively simple, or similar, but it was his instant action without being sure of the raise size that caused this problem in the first place. I thought about giving him $50 out of my pocket, as I had told him he could take it back, but I decided against it. When he asked if he could take the money back, what would you guys have said to him?
It's tough. Depends on a lot of things. You want to go first or should I?
I guess I'll throw some thoughts out there first. I mean, the first thing I would say is as long as there's a third player in the pot, like the money should definitely stay in the pot. Or at least you and the third player would both have to agree to him taking the pot back. So even if it looks like that player is going to fold, it's kind of inconsequential. I think the floor definitely made the right ruling there that he, you know, is not allowed to take that back. If you choose to give him $50 after the hand is over, that's sort of a separate question. It's certainly the villain's responsibility, I would say, to get it right. I am inclined to say there's not like an ethical obligation. That said, this is a situation where I often would return the person's money if I thought that the mistake was genuine, which it sounds like it probably was. It doesn't seem like that's really in doubt. The biggest thing I would be worried about is whether there's some information leak that could potentially happen as a result of my answering that question about, you know, if he says like, is it okay if I take the money back while there's still a third player in the pot, you know, am I somehow going to be leaking information to that third player based on the way that I answer that question? I mean, probably not, but that would be kind of my, like, I guess maybe what I would be likely to say is, you know, we'll discuss it after the hand is over or something along those lines, just to avoid maybe indicating that I do or don't want him to fold or something along those lines.
Yeah. All right. So I will say for the millionth time that there's a difference between the way poker traditionally was and the way poker tends to be now. And it used to be that if you had a gross misunderstanding of the bet, that, you know, you could take your money back and you would get a chance to change your action. And indeed, there used to be this idea that it was part of the bettor's responsibility before he, you know, turned over his hand after getting called to make sure that the amount of his bet had been understood. Now, those ideas seem more or less to be gone and a part of poker history than anything else. But I do think it's not, you know, there's this common idea that, like, no matter what, it's your job to know what the bet size is, and any money that you put in the pot, like, must stay there under all circumstances. And, you know, there you never have any recourse if you've misunderstood the size of the bet. And I certainly try to understand the size of the bet always, but I want to remind people that those ideas haven't always been there, and you know, they're not necessarily, you know, it's just there are other ways of playing that are out there, and it's not like every single consideration that one might have about how to run poker points in favor of those kinds of policies. So in this situation, like certainly in a multi-way pot, I think you need to follow the rules, whatever the rule is. And especially since the person thought that the raise was $50 when the raise was actually $200, it's not clear to me that that's like a gross misunderstanding. Like one rule of thumb you sometimes heard was like 10 times the size of the bet. So like, you know, for a lot of reasons, I can see sort of why the money should stay there. And in a multi-way pot, I definitely like not having side deals. That said, I'd probably let him take the money back. And I think you're also right that in the hand, I would probably just say something like, you know, I'm very happy to let him take it back if that's allowed or something like that, you know. So that's that. After I've won the pot, I'd probably throw him the two green chips. And like, is the dealer really going to say that like I'm passing chips at the table about that? I don't know, maybe. But that's probably what I would do. I'm not sure I have to, and in fact, I'm pretty sure I don't have to, right. But I think it makes sense, but you know, it's, I think it's fine. But for the most part, yeah, I also don't think it's wrong to keep the money. And if it were me putting the 50 in, I wouldn't expect it back. I would take it back. I wouldn't refuse it, but you know, it's, I don't think I'm, you know, reciprocally free rolling anyone. so that's that. Yeah. That's that.
Right, well, thanks very much for writing, Mike. Thanks for using that affiliate link to purchase your toilet bowl pumice cleaning stone. And if anyone else is looking to purchase a toilet bowl pumice cleaning stone or some Temptations cat treats as holiday gifts, please do click that support the podcast tab, find your relevant Amazon link, and shop away. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Nights, do I need some kind of pill or the devotion of a Carmelite or the fair passage of a bill? And who will sign us into law? I know you won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't, you won't, you won't. Will you? You won't, you won't. Time.